Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a mega donor have to think about before pledging hundreds of thousands, millions, or even billions of dollars worth of personal wealth to a philanthropic cause? Especially in tough economic times, the United States and the world stand to benefit greatly from the largesse of high-net-worth humanitarians who commit their money to everything from hunger to highway safety. But as my guest today has learned, far too much donated wealth ends up falling short of benefactors' goals, in part because of a failure to strategically apply the money or to fully empower the organizations entrusted to solve particular problems. Thomas J. Tierney is co-founder and chairman of the Bridgespan Group, a nonprofit that advises the nonprofit sector and its donors. His new book, written with co-author Joel Fleischman, is called Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. Tom, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to join you.
You stress throughout the book that all philanthropy is personal. What does that mean?
Well, philanthropy emanates from a very personal human emotion to help other people. And no two of us are the same in how we think about that. Some people may want to try to cure cancer. Some others may want to preserve part of the environment. There's really no right or wrong answer. And because it's so personal, it can get pretty complicated.
Yeah, we know that most people who give money to a cause sincerely want that money to make a positive difference in the world. Why is there so much ineffective philanthropy at work today?
That's a complicated question. There are lots of different reasons for that. But the primary reason is that it's simply hard to solve social problems. If money were the only answer, we'd have a better education system. We'd have fewer people in poverty. We'd have a healthier environment. It's not just about money. In other words, it's not just about giving. It's about giving smart, meaning one has to be more deliberate, more disciplined, more thoughtful about the results one wants one's philanthropy to achieve.
So you can't just write the check and walk away?
Well, you can, and a lot of us do. We distinguish, that is, Joel and I, between what one might refer to as charity versus giving money away to, in fact, achieve some outcome. So, for example, when I get off the train in the morning, there's a fellow, Jim, there, and Jim is a homeless person who sells papers. The homeless folks in our neighborhood produce this paper called Spare Change. And I always give Jim a few dollars. I'm not expecting anything from that other than him being grateful and me feeling good about that charitable act.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if my wife and I were going to give a few thousand dollars to a particular cause, we'd say, we'd ask ourselves, what do we want that money to achieve? So that's the difference between what we might think about as pure charity and philanthropy aimed at getting results.
One important lesson for potential donors might be that it helps to narrow down the scope of what you hope to achieve, so that a goal like improve the U.S. education system would be better articulated as something like build and support a certain number of great schools. Can you talk about that?
Sure. One of the consequences of the research that we did and the hundreds of interviews and actually looking back in history at successful philanthropy is that we identified a few traps. And these traps are avoidable. But they're sneaky little devils. They're always out there. And one of the traps we labeled fuzzy-headedness. Fuzzy-headedness is exactly what you described. It's saying we want to put our money to work to achieve world peace or to eliminate poverty or to clean the environment, all of which are aspirational and wonderful objectives, wonderful aspirations, but they aren't something you can hold yourself accountable for. So this fuzzy-headedness creeps in when we allow, if you will, our heart to overtake our brain. We allowed our hopes and our aspirations to overtake what is practically doable. The implication of that is translating that aspiration into something you can actually sign up for as a goal. So whereas you may not be able to repair the entire U.S. educational system, you may be able to help a child get through college with financial support. You may be able to help your local school system achieve some things it couldn't otherwise achieve, both through philanthropy and volunteering. So if you will, it's being very clear-minded about the results you're trying to achieve in the context of loftier aspirations.
It's a really interesting example in the book about the couple who made their fortune. They started the clothing retailer Gap, and they wanted to do something about education and committed themselves to charter schools before charter schools were really much of a buzzword in American education.
That Don and Doris Fisher started the Gap, I guess it was in the 60s, and became along the way increasingly concerned about American educational system. And this story, Chris, illustrates a number of, if you will, best practices. They were very clear-minded about what they wanted to achieve. They wanted to achieve more students leading lives that are productive, useful for society. That required a high school education at least and trajectory into college. They ran across the founders of KIPP Academy, which is Knowledge is Power, and they backed those two people early on, and they helped those founders create a better and better organization. They helped them install metrics about how things were actually working. It's a charter management organization. They not only wrote checks, but they devoted time. Don Fisher would visit classrooms, visit schools, help coach and advise the leaders of that organization, and they helped raise money from other donors. They stayed at this for year after year after year. They were relatively focused. One of the other kinds of traps that people fall into is what we labeled peanut butter philanthropy. Now, there's nothing wrong with peanut butter philanthropy. If you want to give a little bit of your money here and a little bit of money there, it's not unlike Jim the homeless fella next to the train station there. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But if you want results, you're probably going to be better off focusing like the Fishers did on a small number of really significant multi-year initiatives like they did with KIPP. Mm-hmm. And KIPP is now a poster child for high-impact charter schools around the U.S.
Another thing that's interesting is that, you know, the Fishers, I think, had significant wealth to have started their own foundation or started their own charter schools, but instead they hunted around for something that maybe wasn't exactly what they had envisioned but came close to what they wanted to do. Talk a little bit about the significance of that.
Well, that's another very insightful question, Chris, because most philanthropy is done through other organizations. In other words, it's rare when the donor decides to start their own nonprofit organization. Sometimes that happens, but then that's fine. But often, philanthropy is the act of giving money and maybe time in support of another entity. Well, by very nature that it's a different entity, they aren't necessarily going to be perfectly aligned with what it is you want to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're 80% aligned, but they're probably not 100% aligned. So there's a tension there between the donor's incentives and dreams and the people running the nonprofit, their day-to-day realities, their incentives, their dreams, and of course they have more than one donor. Mm-hmm. So that's a tension that we may want to talk about in this show, but that's a tension that is incredibly important to address, because to some extent a donor's results are entirely dependent on the performance of the organization they support or organizations they support. So to the extent that relationship is not productive, it's going to undermine the ultimate value to, in this case, the kids in the schools.
So how much influence should a donor imagine he or she is entitled to, depending on the size of a particular gift within that organization?
It's another great question. Most people think about philanthropy as associated with dollar signs, and that's certainly true. But one of the insights in our research was that, in fact, at least as much value seems to be added through donating time and using influence. Mm-hmm. Going back to Don and Doris Fisher, Don devoted enormous amounts of his free time to KIPP Academy and to the issue of charter management organizations. They both volunteered. They helped raise money from other people. This was highly welcome influence. This was influence that I think the KIPP management team wanted more of. They would love to have had more Don and Doris Fishers, because, in fact, it's something they could use, that time and that influence, they could use that effectively to help them succeed. Where there's a problem is when the nonprofit may experience that, quote, influence as meddling. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of examples of that. The most common one is where the donor tries to superimpose their point of view, their strategy, their ideas on the strategy and operations of the nonprofit. And that oftentimes backfires because often the nonprofit organization is a lot more knowledgeable than the donor. They're doing this full-time. It's their profession. They maybe been at it for years, whereas the donor's wading in and wading out. So being clear-minded, if you're a donor, about where you can really add value and how is essential.
You know, I know since you work with both donors and nonprofits that this must be something that you have to negotiate a lot. It is sort of understandable if someone said, well, I've just given you $1 million. I want things done the way I want them. How do these existing foundations and grant recipients manage those relationships, and what can they do to help donors really understand the most appropriate way to interact?
Two-part question there. The first part is poorly, the answer to the first part. In general, those relationships, at least in our experience, there are being both BridgeSpan and my own experience and Joel Fleischman's experience and the hundreds of nonprofits we've worked with, in general, those relationships are poorly managed. What I mean by that is best characterized by a phrase that's bounced around a little bit called the dance of deception. The dance of deception is when you're a nonprofit organization and you're taking money from donors, you need the money more often than not. And the natural human inclination is to tell the donors what they want to hear, to reinforce them and nurture them as you would any type of customer. The donors, of course, want to hear that their money is achieving whatever it is they want it to achieve and want to be treated with respect and treated fairly and warmly for their contribution. All that makes sense. So none of this is anyone's fault, but it is a natural human complication that this relationship between the donor and the grantee is often at the margin just a little bit dishonest. It's not intentionally dishonest, but it's dishonest because the grantee doesn't really have an incentive to say, gosh, that money you gave me last year really didn't generate the results you expected. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they don't even know that for certain. And so there's a natural bias toward good news.
Yeah.
And that bias toward good news can obfuscate what's really going on. So the anecdote to that sort of a problem is what? It's honesty as best as you can. Mm-hmm. It's trust. If you have a trusting relationship between the donor and the grantee, you are more apt to be able to pass on bad news or ask tough questions or express vulnerability. That's the best relations we see between donors and grantees are when they really are partnerships, when they're productive on one hand and when there are shared goals on the other hand.
So does it need to be made clear up front, Tom? We appreciate your gift. We're going to apply it in these ways. We cannot guarantee you that it will produce the results you've asked for.
Yes. In general, more transparency is better on these things. And in fact, the tendency to oversell on everybody's part, on the part of the nonprofit organization overselling what they can really do, and on the part of the donors' part overselling their aspirations and strategic thoughts, mm-hmm. that overselling just ends up undermining results. And so honesty, and it sounds so easy for me to say this on an interview, because it's tough, and I run a nonprofit, and we've raised money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's tough to look the donor in the eye and say, you know what, this is risky. The money you're giving me here may, in fact, not generate the kind of results we both want. Here are the risks. But we got to go into this together with our eyes wide open. Let's not kid each other.
Thomas J. Tierney is my guest. He's co-founder and chairman of the BridgeSpan Group, which advises the nonprofit sector and its donors. He's co-author, along with Joel Fleischman, of the new book Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. You're welcome to join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas J. Tierney, co-founder and chairman of the Bridgespan Group, which advises the nonprofit sector and its donors. He's co-author, along with Joel Fleischman, of the new book Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, I want to talk about another thing that is maybe not sexy anywhere, but particularly when you are wanting to change the world with your philanthropic dollars, and that's overhead. Can you talk a little bit about administrative expenses and how they ought to figure into our giving?
I'm happy to, Chris, and I want to know who thinks overhead isn't sexy.
Maybe it's just me.
There's a pathology in the nonprofit sector that undermines results. And it's a pathology that donors encourage and in some ways even cause. And that pathology can be summed up in the statement that all overhead is bad. All overhead is assumed to be bad. Now, what does that mean? That means that donors naturally like to give money to low overhead organizations because they think those organizations are, quote unquote, better. On one hand, that's completely understandable. It's logical because, of course, you don't want your money, your hard-earned gift, going to spend, be wasted on all this excess overhead. On the other hand, there's bad overhead, which might be excess rent or building expenses or wasted money for whatever reason. But there's good overhead, too. Good overhead is hiring the right people. Hiring a chief operating officer, a great chief financial officer, hiring great program people, paying them fairly, paying them money that they need to be productive, providing this year's laptops as opposed to last century's laptops. All of those things are good overhead. And what happens as a consequence of this bias against overhead is that organizations are underfunded. They may have money for programs, but they don't have the unrestricted money that allows them to actually build the organization that needs to deliver the programs. One of the most popular articles that Bridgespan's written over the years was called The Starvation Cycle. And it was about just this, that because donors don't like to fund overhead, that creates nonprofit incentives to minimize overhead and, frankly, sometimes not report it perfectly accurately, which then encourages donors not to fund overhead, and this cycle starves the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is, because the organization's starved, it's the children they're trying to serve. It's the problems they're trying to solve. It's the communities they're trying to assist that end up suffering.
Because it's not because the money that is donated isn't appropriately able to be sort of allocated.
Well, because the organization doesn't have the capacity to deliver the kinds of results it needs to deliver. It can't, for example, invest in the right kind of staff. So a common problem is you'll see a nonprofit leader wanting to hire a staff person, say a chief operating officer, but they can't get budget for it because donors don't want to see that extra headcount. It's a little bit being penny wise and pound foolish. Think about it this way. I travel a lot. Many people do. You would think I was nuts if I made my choice of an airline based on maintenance costs and said, you know what, I'm going to fly the airline that has the lowest maintenance costs. I'm going to fly the airline that has the oldest planes where parts fall off, where the staff, the pilots are not very good. I want the low-cost airline, not low price, low cost. Of course I wouldn't do that any more than I'd go to a hospital with the worst equipment. So in the nonprofit sector, donors tend to confuse low costs and good results.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Thomas J. Tierney, author of Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. Let's go first on the phones to Colleyville, and we'll speak with Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi. You know, one day I was just sitting back thinking about all these really mega-rich people that donate money to these causes. And one of the things I was thinking about, like the Fishers who own Gap, is if they actually paid their employees a living wage, they wouldn't have as much money to donate.
Well,
I don't know if that question makes sense, but
sure
would actually
does.
Be paying people a good living wage, and they would be spreading the money to people who are actually working for them, and they would have less to donate.
Well, let's get a response for you. Thanks for your call.
I think those are in a way, two different kinds of issues. In other words, competitive marketplaces, take the retailing, for example, like the Gap, compensation is set based on what competitors pay. So if the Gap wants to hire really good people, it has to pay competitively against J. Crew or any other retailer that is in the clothing business and trying to hire the same kind of people. Those compensation levels are set by a marketplace. Independent of that is the question about once wealth is made, however much, maybe it's $1 million, maybe it's $1 zillion, what do people do with it? And one of the most amazing things to me, if you step back and think about it, is that people decide to give away their hard-earned money. They don't have to. In other words, let's assume they're running their businesses as well as they can be run. They're paying people competitively. They're doing all that stuff right. They make money over time. The Fishers are a great example. They made money over decades creating this new business. And then they decide to give a bunch of it away, which they don't have to do at all. And the question then is, once they make that decision to give money away, how can they generate the most benefits for the society that helped them create that wealth in the first place?
Is there a difference, Tom, between donors who sort of increase their giving as their wealth increases, and I'll assume for most people this is over a number of years or decades, and those who somehow wait and then at the not at the last minute, but at one moment decide they're really going to make an impact and perhaps educate themselves using an organization like the Bridgespan Group before they start to make really significant gifts?
There is a difference, and when we wrote this book over the last 2 to 3 years, we detected some patterns. And I'm not sure these are, you never can be certain what the truth is, but this looks to be true. It looks to be true that philanthropists who engage more in their philanthropy, that is, get personally involved over years, end up having better results than the ones who kind of dive in and drop off a bunch of money and swing away.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? It's probably like anything in life. It's hard to do well. And to do something well, you have to practice it. You have to learn. If you thought about the Fishers and Kip, they learned over years and years and years. It's hard to give money away effectively, really, really hard. You can't just hire people to do it. It is the difference between giving and giving smart. And so if there's a pattern, it seems to be that philanthropists who engage more, learn more, and are more apt to give smart.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Oak Cliff, and we'll speak with Mark. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work in the nonprofit sector for a local funding entity, and so this topic is something I live every day, and I'm really glad you're doing something like this. My question is, you were talking about working with high-level donors and educating them about what is realistic in terms of outcomes of their money and what they should expect, and, you know, being realistic in that if they're donating thousands or millions of dollars. On the flip side, how do you work in conjunction with organizations applying for funding who also are sort of big players? They're nationally known organizations who look at having large donations from corporations or individuals and then foundations and say, we are a known commodity, and you should just give us money because we are great, and we have large donors who give to you that think we're great as well, and balance that expectation that even though they are well-known and established, they also should be held to outcomes and metrics that you can go back to those donors and say, you know, make that final connection. The organizations are producing, we're helping you connect to those organizations and use your money in a way that is effective and responsible.
Thanks so much for your call. I'm guessing, Tom, this is an issue that you have a great deal of familiarity with.
I do. And, Mark, I'm so glad you flagged this topic because, in fact, this issue of communication and transparency goes both ways. It is both from the recipient to the donor and from donors to the recipients. And oftentimes, nonprofit organizations, especially the, understandably, the really successful ones, are not as open, transparent, clear-minded as they need to be with donors. What, you know, we make the statement in the book that, and it's a little bit of a bold statement, but both Professor Fleischman and I feel strongly about it, that on average, philanthropy underperforms. And I don't know how much it underperforms. I don't know if we could take the $300 billion that Americans give away each year and double the impact or increase the impact by 10%. I don't know. But I do know one thing. That is that if donors and the nonprofits they support, it's a two-way street, can increase the level of clear thinking and honest communication that goes between them, it will have, it will create the condition under which that those results downstream can be significantly improved. And I think, therefore, the burden is not just on the donor side, it's on the nonprofit side as well. You know, donors often want to try to, quote, over-control the nonprofit. The nonprofits on the other side, you know, you close the door after the donors leave the room. They say, just, you know, basically give us the money so we can get on with what we're doing. And neither of those two points of view are exactly right when you're trying to serve society.
So how do you measure the impact of your donation?
Do you have any simple questions?
We don't specialize in this here, but we don't mind raising questions that aren't easily answered. If
okay. I could see why your show's called Think. This makes people think. There has been quite a bit of attention around the idea of results measurement, especially going back about 15 years. In fact, if you track it in the United States and philanthropic circles, you know, the idea of measuring return on social investment or all kinds of fancy words like that has gradually increased to the point now where most significant donors, that is large or heavily engaged donors, are asking, how do I know if I'm getting results for my money?
Mm-hmm.
The watch out in all of this is that we allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. What I mean by that is sometimes you can measure results pretty well. If a group of people are paying to have an auditorium, they're contributing to the building of an auditorium in a local school or an athletic field or something, you know when that athletic field is finished. You know, you went and can see when those art supplies have been purchased. Other kinds of philanthropy, it's harder than heck to measure the impact. What if you're supporting an after-school program for poor children? How do you know exactly what value added that after-school program is delivering? The best you can do there is not necessarily measure results, but judge results.
Mm-hmm.
So what we tell people, or I do anyhow, is you can always develop an educated point of view as to what seems to be working well and what isn't working well. I had this funny conversation with a board of directors of a foundation, once a pretty large foundation, and really smart people in the room, and I asked them about the, you know, they've been making grants for years to dozens of nonprofit organizations, and I said, which of these grants over all these years are in your bottom quartile, your bottom 25%? And one of the, a very thoughtful man, piped up. He must have been tired. He said, we don't have a bottom 25%. I said, really? And then he paused and, of course, caught himself. But what I'm saying with that little story is that asking simple questions about what's working and what isn't working can oftentimes be a proxy for, be satisfactory way of judging progress.
What can a million-dollar donor learn by spending an afternoon shadowing someone on the ground level of an organization?
A lot. Again, going back to the premise that engaged donors generate more results than disengaged or absentee donors, it is really common for successful people who have been successful in business, say, to underestimate the degree of difficulty in driving social change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is harder to change a life than it is to make a widget. That's just a fact. And it's harder for a whole bunch of reasons that we could get into if it made sense. But one, for example, is it's hard to measure whether you're really changing that life. Another is that if you're doing a good job, money doesn't necessarily flow to you. So by getting a little bit more engaged, by going to that nonprofit, spending a day in that charter school, spending a day in that public school, if that's what you care about, walking the grounds of the arts organization that you want to support, those sorts of things develop your capacity to understand the degree of difficulty. Philanthropy looks easy at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like so many things in life. When you haven't done it before, it looks easier.
Do you find that nonprofits tend to over-manage those interactions between big donors and ground-level employees for fear of scaring off major donors who suddenly realize that their money won't change everything right away?
Not the best nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the watch-outs for all of us is to, you know, generalize either about nonprofits or business or anyone. You know, on average, business is average. On average, nonprofits are average.
Mm-hmm.
When one compares, though, the very best businesses and the very best nonprofits, you see different behaviors. And the very best nonprofits, I think, engage their donors in a really constructive way. That's not necessarily typical, but that's what makes the best the best.
We have an email here from Margot in Temple who wants to know if small individual donations, say $25 to the Alzheimer's Association, really make a difference to the organization.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, my mother has been involved in philanthropy. She's just turned 84, involved in philanthropy for decades, and I would be surprised if any of her gifts have been above $50. And she asks me that same question. And I say, Mom, every dollar counts to important organizations. And remember what I said about funding good overhead. Those $25 contributions are unrestricted. They allow the organization to pay for its employees, to pay its rent, to buy new laptops. So those little organizations made with caring and commitment by individual donors are enormously important.
Thomas J. Tierney is with us. His new book is called Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. We'll resume the discussion in a moment. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas J. Tierney, co-founder and chairman of the Bridgespan Group, which advises the nonprofit sector and its donors. His new book, written with Joel Fleischman, is called Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, you spoke about the fact that sometimes money and, time and influence are worth at least as much as a donor's money. Talk for a minute about the extent to which major donors tend to influence their peers.
It's another great question, Chris. Because philanthropy is personal, it tends to be siloed. That is, people tend to want to do their own thing. What has happened over the last decade in particular is more and more collaboration is occurring. You see that through established foundations like the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation creating a growth capital fund and raising $120 million from, I think, 19 different donors to fund three human service organizations. Extraordinary. You see that through organizations like the Robin Hood Foundation that have annual events that raise tens of millions of dollars, in this case, for poverty-related issues in New York City. You see environmental organizations or donors like Packard and Hewlett and the Moore Foundation collaborating around major environmental initiatives. It is enormously important when it occurs. That said, it doesn't occur frequently enough. One of those traps that we mention in Give Smart is the trap of flying solo.
Mm-hmm.
that because philanthropy is personal, people have a natural inclination to go do their own thing without trying to learn from others who have already tried to do that same thing, or maybe doing it better than they could ever do it. If philanthropy in the world is to accomplish what it can accomplish, it will require less flying solo and more collaboration.
Is that a tough lesson for someone who is accustomed to being at the top of his or her career and maybe has the money to give because he or she started a corporation of their own?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, my gosh, yes. And in fact, you know, the great irony is that, you know, is that while money is made alone in the sense that there is a human being who is paid or has shares of a company and the wealth comes back to a particular taxpayer, that is, money is made alone, social change is almost never accomplished alone. It is hard to think of any significant social change, even at a local school district or a small local community, that has occurred with one person acting unilaterally without a single bit of assistance from anybody else, from another private person, from the government, from anyone. It just doesn't happen. And so in the for-profit sector, what do? We compete. We compete, and the winner wins and gets the goodies. In the social sector, with philanthropy, the goal is collaboration, not competition. And that's a tough lesson for folks.
So talk about Warren Buffett signing on with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Well, now let's see. That's another big question. What exactly would you like me to talk about there? It's unprecedented.
Well, first of all, the idea that there is this existing foundation, Buffett has more than enough wealth to do whatever he wanted and decided to sort of partner with an existing organization to commit to donating his wealth.
The reason that is turning out to be one of the most important milestones in the history of philanthropy is it is an extraordinary example of the kind of collaboration that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett made his fortunes by picking great managers, running great companies. And that's essentially what he did with his philanthropy. He's betting on Bill and Melinda, their foundation, Jeff Rakes, the CEO, to deliver the kinds of results that if he were doing it, he would want to deliver. He doesn't feel he has to do that himself, and in fact understands that they are probably a lot better at it, at least he said this, than he would ever be.
Mm-hmm.
That idea that I'm going to put my money behind someone else is a wonderful illustration of philanthropy. I think the trend around giving while living, which is committing your money to others while you're still alive, is an important trend and, in fact, evidenced to some extent by Warren Buffett's gift.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Kyle on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kyle.
Hi there. First, Ms. Cherney, great insights. I appreciate all the work that you've done in this area. But I wanted to ask specifically, in my situation, I had been a financial CFO for an organization and turned it around by helping focus the business and basically by buying some of the common business practices that you find in the for-profit world and the nonprofit world. How much can we increase the efficiency of nonprofits by investing, as you said, in that overhead and in structures to help an organization be more efficient? And how can a donor look at and evaluate the efficiency of the organization, as you said, at the overhead level?
Great questions, Kyle. And I think they are, let me tackle them both. First of all, from all of our experience, and that is both Joel Fleischman and I and Bridge Spann, and we've been at this 10 years and hundreds of organizations, we think there's dramatic upside by building the capacity of the organization to actually do its job better. And some of it's quite simple. It's hiring the right financial people. It's having the right basic systems. It's having clear-minded strategies. None of this has to be rocket science. So that is hugely important. If you said, how can a donor sort of evaluate the capacity of an organization to deliver results? Kicking the tires. And at the end of the day, nothing matters more than having the right people in the right job. And in this in this context, it's not a lot different than, you know, venture capital or private equity or any of those kinds of investments where investors will say, when asked what matters most, they will say people matter most. And so for a donor to meet the organization, get to know the organization, walk the halls a little bit, develop their own judgment about are these A players or B players is essential. And there's no substitute for it. You can't go through a bunch of papers and figure that out. You actually have to go person to person and reach your own conclusions.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line to Fort Worth, and we'll speak with Jeannie. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, how are you?
Great,
thanks. Thank you for doing this program. It's
sure.
Great.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. What's on your mind, Jeannie?
My question is, I have many years raised money for different nonprofits that I believe in close to my heart, and I'm one of the fortunate ones to see where the water hits the well. And I make my modest donation, and then I use my time and contacts to get other people to donate. And they're all pleased because when you tell them about walking the halls, come down and look at the 10 kids here, the 100 that are scholarship and youth sport. Let me take you over here at this group and show you the single parents that do that. Nobody knows them. Those are all private donations. But what I'm hearing more lately is, and my question is, how important is the financial stability of the national organization? For instance, the YMCA sends their program fees in, the American Red Cross to their national, the Alzheimer's Association. And now I'm getting questions like, well, what about that national organization? I don't want my money going to Chicago or New York or something. And you can designate it in your community. But when the volunteers in your community have made their budget, see all of the programs and services continuously help, and maybe the feeling in the community is that the national organization might not be good stewards of their money.
What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, you know, I've been involved in national organizations off and on for about 30 years, Jeannie, and you know, some things never change. It's like that old saying in business, I'm here from corporate and I'm here to help. What I mean by that is there is a natural and well-grounded concern when people are focused on local giving that somehow the national organization is going to undermine that or tax that or something. And the only way around that is to focus people on what they really care about and not let them be distracted by the national organization that is never going to be seen as perfect, ever. But get them focused on those local kids, those local issues. That's where most of their money, if not all their money, is going. That's what will pull their heartstrings. That's what will motivate them and encourage them to come back year after year.
Small private investors, people who are saving for things like retirement, are told to sort of check in on what you're doing every quarter or so and maybe rebalance that often or at least once a year. Does that make sense for people who are making very large benevolent donations to places?
Paying close attention matters a lot. However, the general pattern seems to be that one achieves better results if one does fewer, bigger, longer. Mm-hmm. Fewer things in a bigger way, whatever that means for a particular person or foundation, for a longer period of time.
Yeah.
And does that require checking in? Yes, it absolutely requires checking in. But at the same time, it requires a kind of a commitment and loyalty that transcends any given 90-day period. You know, the average foundation grant in America lasts under 3 years. And 36 months is just not a very long time. If you're trying to, you know, fix a broken school system or create an after-school program for poor kids or whatever. And so there's this short-term orientation because people are worried that their money may be wasted or because they don't do enough homework up front to be sure of what they want to commit to in the first place. So, yes, absolutely be vigilant. Check in. But also, when you make a commitment, make it make fewer of them for longer periods of time, you're likely to generate more results at the end of the day.
We have time, I think, for one more call. Let's go to Donnie in Dallas. Hey, Donnie.
Hi. I've been doing nonprofit as a volunteer off and on for about 30 years, and about a month ago, the universe dope slapped me about the tsunami survivors, that, you know, we can throw money at them, but they're individuals, and suffering what they've suffered, we need to kind of deal with them as individuals. I went back to a program that World War One, World War II Red Cross did about handing out yarn to knit, and I'm not having a problem finding people willing to donate yarn, but when I try to talk to people about shipping and receiving, because I don't want to touch any of this stuff, I don't want to be responsible for it, I'm getting shined on. I have an appointment Tuesday with the American Red Cross about distribution, but how do I break through that glass ceiling of getting someone to talk to me?
Well, no magic answers here. I think you're doing exactly the right thing, which is be persistent. You know, when a crisis like this occurs and it's so unprecedented, and the infrastructure, the organizations aren't oriented necessarily to provide this kind of assistance to the Japanese, the reaction time is slower. And so no magic advice here. I think you talk to the premier aid organizations, keep chipping away. They're probably a little slow to respond in some cases, but my guess is you'll ultimately succeed.
We haven't talked a lot, Tom, today about gut instinct, but I wonder how important that is for successful philanthropists.
You know, it's no different than in business. At the end of the day, judgment matters most.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about this idea of giving smart as opposed to just writing checks, the smart part is not just about your brain. It's also about your instincts, your judgment, your gut. It's a combination of both. In fact, you could say, if you want to be cute about it, it's your brain, your gut, and your heart. Your heart has to pull you in a certain direction. Your brain has to be analytic and say, you know what, this is smart, this isn't so smart, I'm gonna proceed this way. And then your gut at the end of the day tells you, you know what, I can't measure everything, can't be sure, but this one feels right.
Does everything we've talked about today for people who are giving thousands or millions of dollars also apply to those of us who might give hundreds or low thousands of dollars in a year?
Of course. In fact, I had somebody tell me the other day, you know, the book just came out, whatever, 10, 14 days ago, and the fellow was saying, you know what, $2,000 to me is worth more than $10 million to Bill Gates.
Sure.
Whether
yeah.
that's true or not, I don't know, but it probably was, and it certainly felt that way to him. And so all the same ideas, this notion of asking questions, it's why the book's organized around questions. Asking questions. You may only spend 30 minutes asking those questions to yourself. You may need to spend 90 days asking those questions. But asking the questions, if I have $2,000 to give, do I want, for example, to give it out to 20 different organizations?
I'm going to have to interrupt you and leave it there because we're out of time. The new book by Thomas J. Tierney and Joel Fleischman is called Give Smart, Philanthropy That Gets Results. Tom, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.